Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
What time is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
We're 4 weeks out from our opening World Cup fixture against Scotland. We've just suffered our biggest ever defeat against England, shipping 8 tries in the process. And next up, we have to go to Cardiff to play the role of crash test dummies for Wales' final warm-up game, which also doubles as Warren Gatland's last ever match in charge of his country at the... Well, it might as well be his country at the Millennium Stadium. So where is it now? I know I left it here somewhere. Yeah, there it is, yeah.
Extraordinarily annoying.
But it's a panic button. Well, that's what it is.
I got there, but I'm just concerned about the...
No, I'm really panicked there. I better press it again. It was really annoying.
Turn that down a little. I know it's not a panic button. It's not really loud and annoying, but...
That is even more annoying than I expected. I might have a lot of use for the panic button over the next couple of months. Every time we suffer defeat, Murph, that panic button's getting played.
Well, Owen, I think, you know...
Hi, Murph, by the way. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Owen. Hello to you.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone.
I mean, I think by dint of constant use, you can't keep using the panic button. I mean, I think you panic the first couple of times, and then after a while, that becomes the new normal.
Well, no, going by that logic, you'd never wake up to your alarm clock.
Well, no, I mean, that's necessary. I'm not panicking when I wake up. I'm like, okay, I need to get up now. I mean, that's just a snooze button.
This is the laissez-faire attitude that many Irish people have towards fire alarms, for example. they go off in your building, everyone sits around going... Mm.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if the fire alarm is going off every day, as yours...
We're not going to lose every. Are we going to lose to Wales twice in a row? Never, Murph. There's no way that will ever happen.
Really? Did you see the game on Saturday?
Scotland. There's no way we'll slip up against Scotland. I don't see that as a banana skin.
That is true. Yeah, we do handle Wales and Scotland every time. All right.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting a little tired of England inflicting massive psychological blows on our team in 2019. Once was enough. If you remember back to the start of February, we were all feeling fairly cock-a-hoop going into the opening weekend of the Six Nations at home to Eddie Jones and his team. By the end of that 80 minutes, England had secured a bonus point win, and by Joe Schmidt's own admission, the Irish players were left broken by the experience. He said a bit broken, but it sounds more spectacular if you get rid of the a bit part of it there. And now we have to deal with it all over again. Now, I know you're saying, Ken, it shouldn't feel quite as devastating as that. Only a warm-up match. I mean, nothing technically was at stake, really. And that sort of rationale would be comforting to me if we'd lost 37.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. 37-19, maybe.
Yeah.
But 57-15. Forget about the 15-19. We're splitting hairs there. Mm. It's the 57. That's a worry. That's not good. Am I right?
Bowden Barrett will eat them alive.
Sorry, say it again?
Bowden Barrett will eat them alive.
Well, if we get that far, I'm not worried about Bowden Barrett. I'm worried about Gregor Townsend.
He's our worries right now, to be honest.
No, Gregor Townsend's not even playing, obviously, but I'm worried about his technical brain and
I don't understand
touchline.
why they want to play World Cup warm-ups of this nature.
Go on.
What's the point in lining
up? He might
up?
Actually be onto something here, so do go on.
What is the point in lining up a series of pre-World Cup friendlies, you know, one against, like, industrial meat grinder, the next one against, like, a juggernaut speeding down the highway? What is the point?
I've literally no idea.
Because all that ever seems to happen is everybody gets injured and concussed and their spirits are broken, their dignity is taken away, and then they go out to the World Cup and get knocked out in the quarterfinals or group stage. So,
well, that happens to us.
Have we? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So why do we keep doing this? Has anyone ever thought of maybe the warm-ups don't need to be like full crash ball, bone breaking,
how do you avoid
skull shattering collisions?
How do you avoid that? I mean, if you're playing against the likes of England, Wales,
play the USA.
Well, Scots are playing Georgia twice.
Yeah.
Simon, I'd like to bring you in here. I mean, is it just we need these big games and sellouts to pay for, you know, the sport?
I think it is money as well. Yeah.
I mean, it does strike me as like watching us tackle Mauro Itoje, Billy Vunipola, and Manu Tuilagi for 80 minutes on Saturday. I was like, there's a reason why we shouldn't be doing this, and is it not obvious to everyone? This seems bizarre.
And us being demoralized and injured going into the World Cup and doing crap in the World Cup would probably lose us money too in the long run.
Of course, when we set all this up, I mean, we might have, you know, when these fixtures were set up, we might have thought we'd be in a great spot. We could have had a good Six Nations.
But I don't get these meticulous coaches like Eddie O'Sullivan, Joe Schmidt, men who pour over every detail, obsess about every little factor that's going into the game. And then Joe, after the game, admits that Ireland were going to be pretty tired anyway, coming off the Portugal, essentially like a fitness camp.
Yeah.
To play England, who are already a couple of weeks ahead of us in their preparation. And then, Eddie O'Sullivan couldn't get a game, and all of a sudden we played Bayonne, who hated us and knocked out Brian O'Driscoll.
How do
these things happen when every other detail is supposedly taken care of?
I do like this. Rather than focus on the rights and wrongs of our performance on Saturday, we're actually attacking the entire system in which the game happened.
Look, don't worry, we're doing the performance with Shane Horgan.
We'll get there. Okay, that's okay.
What's the injury list now?
Not too bad. Keen Healy will be okay. Conor Murray passed head injury assessment, but you know, went off at halftime just a precaution.
Sexton, that was a story in the Sunday Times that he got an injury in training.
A mole fell on him, an Irish mole.
Joey Carberry looks like the more likely one to miss out entirely.
So Carberry, he's a
out half.
Sexton is an out half.
Correct.
Murray is the scrum half.
Yeah, we could go through all the positions.
You've really got the hang of this.
It's interesting targeting of injuries in that one particular sort of brain area of the team, right?
Mm.
I mean, it just seems like an unacceptable casualty, right, to me.
Listen, I mean, I think we're going to have to fulfill this fixture anyway on Saturday, but maybe we should think about, you know, playing the Connacht under-20s or something.
Well, there was some...
I actually think that's not a bad idea. Like, what is the point in going to Cardiff next Saturday with anyone that will play in the World Cup?
Make them feel amazing about heading off to the World Cup.
Listen, Warren, this is our thank you for 10 great years as Welsh manager. We're just going to stand aside and let your Welsh boys, you know, puff up their numbers. Everyone's going to run in a couple of tries. Everyone's going to feel good about themselves. And we say to you, Warren, thank you.
Mm.
Thank you for being a good neighbour all these years. And we'll play our actual
Giants to you. That's the...
Big man.
There was some good news last night provided by Rory McIlroy, who held off Brooks Koepka to win the Tour Championship in America. And with it, win the prize money of $15 million.
Mm.
It's a bit obscene probably, but it's the biggest payday in the history of the sport. Although speaking before the event, McIlroy was keen to stress that he's not all about the Benjamins.
Like, who knows what the winner wins at the Masters? I don't know, but you know, that's because that's not what it's about. So if, again, the FedEx Cup wants to create a legacy that lasts longer, it doesn't need to be about the money. It should be about the prestige of winning an event that you'll be remembered for. So I don't think it needs to be, I don't think the money needs to be front and center, because I don't think that's what the fans care about. Yeah, players might care about it, and you know, we want to be rewarded and paid for what we do, but at the same time, it's not, you know, competitively, it's not about that. It's about trying to win golf tournaments.
Yeah, but when you're the guy who ends up winning the 15 mil,
maybe this
you're going to take it.
Maybe this changes a guy's mind. You know, my perspective has shifted somewhat over the course of 5 days.
What's
the
second prize?
It's a great question. Which
nothing can second.
That would be fun. Which my wife asked me last night as well, isn't it?
$15 million for the winner. Yeah. That is a lot.
Yeah, it's gone from 10 to 15. Yeah. I just thought 10 wasn't really going to take.
And is that the biggest purse for any tournament?
Well, I just said it was the biggest purse in history. Ken.
Oh, okay.
So,
it will be.
Alex Myers of Golf Digest is going to be on later. Murph, if you find that fact, it's fine. I'm not too concerned about the
$5 million quid for finishing second in this tournament. Mm. Wow. $4 million for third, $3 million for fourth, $2.5 million for fifth. Yeah, that's a lot of money. Everyone in the top eight gets over $1 million.
It's not just sport on the Second Captain's World Service. As our members well know, they've been greatly enjoying the Kennedy Political Podcast. Last week's guest was Matthew O'Toole, former Brexit spokesperson for 10 Downing Street, who explained what he thinks, well, how he rates Boris Johnson's communication strategy on his Brexit policy so far.
If
He seriously thinks that the European Union are, at the very last minute, going to make a concession that enables him to pass a deal in the Commons, then I think we're probably in a bit of difficulty, unless he is planning to do something quite surprising in terms of shifting his own position and performing a U-turn himself at the last minute and presenting a fig leaf concession, by which I mean, you know, something like a representation of the political declaration as a massive concession. But at the minute, there are no signs that he's doing that. All the signs are that he and his team are rhetorically and even logistically running as hard as you possibly can at the 31st of October and waiting to see what gets in their way. In a sense, we're sometimes tempted to ascribe rationality or a kind of a deeper kind of purpose and a deeper and more complicated Machiavellian plan, because sometimes that reassures us that feels a bit more
someone's organizing this.
Organized, you know. It's like life generally, we look for patterns, we want to see patterns, we want to see meaning, whenever it might be a little bit more scary than that. It might just be run hard at it and see what gets in the way.
It's a brilliant interview, and it's available in full once you sign up on secondcaptains.com. And if the politics pod isn't enough for you, how about Richie Sadler's Player's Chair, which returns tomorrow? That is tomorrow, Tuesday. Richie's interview with Mayo's Andy Moore, and we'll kick off our build-up to the All-Ireland Football Final, which will go all week. If you feel like signing up to hear all of that, just go to secondcaptains.com/join. Ah, there's nothing like a record defeat against England at Twickenham to get you in the mood for the World Cup, is there? Gerry Thorny witnessed the carnage. Hi, Gerry.
Yeah, it was really getting you in the mood for the World Cup.
Oh, you look stunned. And Shane Horgan has just about recovered, I hope. Shane, how are you?
I'm good.
Honestly, though, Shane, how are you? I mean, I want us to give you a scale of 1 to 10. How worried are you now about the Rugby World Cup after what you saw?
I was worried beforehand. I don't know where... I suppose what the expectations are now. So, you know, a little over a year ago, we were looking at this Irish team thinking that there's a realistic chance of them winning the World Cup. There's no realistic chance of them winning the World Cup at the moment. And, you know, there's concerns how they'll actually perform in it. So I think we are seeing a really, you know, crucial point in time, and we're just wondering, I'm thinking, whether we can write this. Listen, first things first, I think England are a very good team. I think they might be my favourite for the World Cup. They're playing with all the sort of elements that I like to see in rugby. They've got now kicking game from 9, 10, 12, 15, a legitimate kicking game, and they use it off all those kickers. Their interplay between forwards and backs is really excellent. They play flat. They're super powerful. They have really quick lines, line speed and defence. And, you know, they have a couple of exceptional individual players as well. So they are serious contenders. But if you look at all the qualities that they have, you can almost look at Ireland in the negative, because in each of those areas, Ireland fell down in.
So you're not just writing this off in any way as a bit of ring rustiness or, you know, a pre-season friendly, any of that stuff. You're genuinely concerned.
Yeah, well, you can't write it off. You can't. We are where we are. You know, it was a particularly bad day. It was a particularly bad performance. But it's not out of the blue. You know, the last Six Nations wasn't good. You know, we tried to look at the positives from it, but in the, you know, two crucial games, you know, we didn't perform, and actually our performances through, you know, from Christmas onwards haven't been good. So this is, you know, that was a very, very poor result at the weekend, and there's not a huge amount of time to make the sort of changes that Ireland need to make to have a really successful World Cup. I don't think, you know, we don't necessarily going to have a disaster, and I think, you know, against moderate teams, Ireland can do well. But, you know, the idea of Ireland getting from where they are now to a position where they could win a World Cup just seems, you know, doesn't seem likely at all, does it?
No, and I don't know if anyone as Shane has alluded to, nobody's really talking about that right now anyway. But, I mean, we're still talking about hopefully topping a group, hopefully getting into a quarterfinal, hopefully being able to somehow beat New Zealand or South Africa in that quarterfinal. With all that said, Gerry, is there one particular part of what you saw on Saturday that is most concerning to you? Was it a general malaise? Is that what would concern you most? Or is there any particular area you can pick out that you thought, geez, this is bad and not necessarily fixable?
Hard to limit it to just one.
Right. Well, give us a couple, so.
Well, I wasn't really looking forward to coming in when I heard it was going to be on with Shane Horgan, because I knew he wasn't going to cheer me up, and he hasn't. And that performance didn't cheer me up. I was a bit more shocked than Shane. I figured the Six Nations would go badly. I didn't expect Ireland to win on Saturday. I didn't think the fixture fell at a good time coming immediately from Portugal on the Thursday. And what I've been hearing about what they've been doing in pre-season camp, it's been very fitness-based. So I feared for them, given that England just seemed to be so much more match-hardened, had already picked their squad, had this whole week to prepare for this game, and were preparing for this game, and just had that Saracens core to their pack, was going to have a... You know, much whereas Ireland were like ring rusty, 12 players come in making their seasonal debuts at Twickenham. But that being said, yeah, the general malaise for sure, even Joe Schmidt used that exact word, the general malaise in the performance was very disconcerting, very worrying to watch, hard to watch. After a reasonably encouraging opening quarter, their legs just seemed to go. They lost all line speed in defence, watching them. Their lack of communication in defence was palpable. England's ability to open them up three times off first phase, off scrums, and score tries directly is just a really damning indictment of the defence. I thought the system, such that it was, left the wingers incredibly exposed and did them no favours, particularly Jacob Stockdale. It was a large part to do with people biting in the inside. And like, you look at that try that Manu Tulagi scored off a 5-metre scrum. You wouldn't expect that to see that at schoolboy level, where Bundy
Aki, bad pass, from England.
It looked like everybody looked like they were obsessed with trying to stop Billy Vunipola coming off the base. That's what they'd seen him do for Saracens against Leinster in the final, and Bundy actually ran into Nigel Owens, and it was just hard to watch. So I'd say the defence was obviously a big concern, but the attack wasn't a whole lot better. But that being said, there was almost no platform when you lose six lineouts, three of them attacking, three in the defensive, which effectively contributed 21 points to England's grand total. And that, of course, though I hate to say it, I don't want to scapegoat them, but that, because everybody went down with the sinking ship. But the captain, he's got the pressure of captaincy in all of this. And of course, he's turned 37 years of age. And he had a bad day at the office against Wales in March in Cardiff. And now he's had another bad day. So I think, all in all, what I'd be most concerned about would be the damage it's done mentally and psychologically to this group. They must be a bit stunned themselves, the coaching staff and the players. As Shane will know better than I do, it's very hard to come off a heavy defeat like that and just, you know, it certainly would be a wake-up call, but it's got to be damaging. There's got to be a residual damage from it, not least in terms of the trust in each other at defensive time and in the trust in their line-out. And it's even, in turn, raised selection issues and issues around the captaincy.
Yeah, Shane, is that the biggest issue in your head and in your experience when things start going wrong? Is that the hardest bit to turn around, the psychological element?
It depends where you are. It depends what's going on in training. Depends on what's on in the camp. Sometimes a bad performance can happen and it can be completely at odds with what's going on in the camp and the feeling of the players and what their own, I suppose, expectations are or where they feel they are in their cycle. And they probably have, Jerry pointed out there, they probably are on the back of a very heavy training load. But if that can only excuse so much. And, they knew this fixture was there. They knew it was against England. And to put themselves in a position where, they're going to ship 50 and look so impotent is not a good basis for a successful World Cup campaign. So that needed, that should be factored in. So, to answer your question, it depends on what the players are feeling. But this is not, as I said, it's not an isolated game. There's not a huge bank of performances in the last 9 months that players can reflect on and say we can get to that pretty easily. And then you've got a couple of major issues around selection as well. And you mentioned Rory Best there. This has been coming for Rory Best, and we've all probably put our head in the sand a little bit about it, because Rory has been a good captain. He's a guy that people like, and we don't have, the other thing is, we don't have a huge amount of depth at hooker, but he's 37, and it's not to be unexpected. It's not unexpected that, you know, he's going to be tailing off at this point of his career, even though there's a World Cup around the corner. You can't fight these things sometimes. And, you know, he looked at every day at 37 at the weekend.
The options there, though, Shane, I mean, you know, Joe Schmidt has never starts Sean Cronin, and he's not going to start Sean Cronin in the World Cup. So you've got, what, Niall Scannell, Rob Herring. Is Schmidt really going to drop his captain and one of his most valued players for any of these guys?
Well, we would have said up to this point, you know, no. And I think he may have been wavering during the Six Nations, and he gave Sean Cronin an opportunity, and Sean Cronin didn't take that opportunity. And then it was like the conversation was over. It was, oh, well, you know, Sean Cronin didn't play well. He actually had a really poor game. And so, you know, Rory comes straight back in at two, and the questions are, you know, not answered. But the problem is the questions are still there. And the questions that were applied to Hooker, and the reasons why, so, you know, there was sort of an outcry, or even within Joe's own thought process, he had a proper look at Sean Cronin, was because, you know, Rory hasn't been delivering. And this is tough. You know, it's a very tough conversation. It's tough on him, but he hasn't been. So, you know, just because Sean Cronin didn't go well there doesn't mean that problem is solved. So, you know, where else do you look to? And you're right. I don't think Joe's going to look to Sean Cronin. I think he really lost his confidence in him and trust in him. So, you know, is it Scandal? And I think, you know, there may have to be a look. He may have to look there, you know. And that means also not just, you know, from the Hooker perspective, but also from the captaincy perspective. You know, it takes away a leader. But I think what the weekend showed was Ireland are missing a little bit in that. There wasn't enough good performances through a really bad team performance. And, you know, there are people that just have to dig in, you know, and, you know, deliver a personal performance. And we just didn't, when a team isn't going well, and we didn't see enough of that.
The problem as well is that we can't just isolate the Hooker's throwing. It's one of the most difficult skills in the game. Aiming at this imaginary target 25 metres away, 20 metres away or whatever, and 15 metres off the ground. It's a very, very difficult skill. But it helps when the system works. And the system malfunctions as well. It's not just down to the thrower. It's down to the calling. Ireland only has one caller, Devon Toner, really. The Irish lineout never really works that well when Devon Toner's not on the pitch. Now, I know it didn't work great when he was on it in the end game either, but Ian Henderson is not an experienced lineout caller. James Ryan's not an experienced lineout caller. It hinges on Devon so much. And as you saw with England the weekend, when you've got a Saracen's spine to your lineout, when you've got the Hooker in both locks, it's just a very well-oiled machine. And also, they're probably one of the best defensive lineouts in the world, because they would have known Rory Best and Ian Henderson from Lions tours. And it was very clever the way they threw up George Cruz and Hunnam up the front of the lineout on a couple of occasions, Mauro Tosi in another. And it basically blocked Rory Best's view of his intended target, and they knew what they were doing. And then they would get a Tosi in the air when the ball landed, and they picked off three of the throws, or picked off two of them, and one was an overthrow by Sean Cronin. So they'd done their homework. There's a myriad of factors here. There's a concertina effect, but it does, of course, start with the thrower, and you know, he has to carry the can. But I think Ian Henderson, unfortunately, has to carry the can as well, yep, despite having done some things very well.
There were still a few of them that were just...
And also, the other thing as well, of course, is Ireland, as much as anybody, absolutely depend on their line-out as the launching pad for pretty much all they do.
Shane?
Yeah, but it's also not just about the line-out as well. And, you know, Hooker's probably unfairly, and Jerry pointed out reasons why, unfairly...
The flag.
Singled out when the line out goes wrong. But, you know, if that was the only issue, Jerry, at two, then, you know, at least you could work on that. It's not, you know, and it highlights the problem more drastically. But you think, where are the carries? Where is the ferocity and the clean out? Where is, you know, where are the interplay between forwards and backs for the two? You know, what, you know, where are the turnovers? That is, you know, it's a huge part of Rory's game as well. So if he's not offering that, you know, and the line-out's not going well, you know, what's been delivered here, you know?
Plus,
it has to be, we have to have more. It's an area that, you know, in our team that we're not delivering on. And it was just really massively highlighted at the weekend. But lineouts aside, aside from that, you would be looking. There's not enough being offered by our two.
No. Fair point. And the thing is, Shane, if your leader is playing that badly, then his words are kind of empty.
Yeah, and that's the last situation you want to be in. And don't get me wrong, Rory is really well respected, and he would have a lot of goodwill in the bank. And he would not just goodwill, but he'd have a lot of respect from all those players that they would know that he has delivered time and time again for Ireland, and he has. But at some point, and especially when things start going badly, you start looking around the room and going, everyone, first things first, everyone has to deliver on their own performance. And, there's no doubt, Rory will put his hand up and he will have done so already and said, that's not acceptable. And, he'll have to deliver better performances. And you get that, and you get that pass, and maybe you get two passes with that. But after a number of really bad performances, and it's all highlighted, there's no hiding place. Everybody will be in the team room. The players who are making the mistakes will have to put up their hands. So, Rory's will be going up. At some point, players just lose confidence, not just in the words of the captain, but they start saying, well, this potentially, if this player continues to play badly, he's impinging on or affecting what we can do and how we can achieve what we want to do. And if that happens, then you're in big trouble really quickly.
Shane, you were talking in last year's Six Nations about how our defensive system seemed a little bit out of date compared to England and Wales. Like 34 missed tackles, that's maybe individual errors at times and brilliant English runners. But in the way that the likes of Stockdale and Kearney were struggling to come up at speed and not really making any proper hits or intercepts or really pressuring the passer at any stage, does it look like we're trying to change our defensive system and not adapting or not doing it properly, or are we just doing the old one even worse than before?
Well, just on the 34 missed tackles, the reasons that we have that many tackles, yes, the England team carried very strongly and they've got brilliant individual carriers and have extreme power right across the team. But the reason that we missed that many tackles is because we're not defending aggressively enough, and we're putting ourselves in positions where we aren't getting to the pitch of the ball quickly enough. To be beaten around the corner a couple of times as we were just shouldn't happen at all. That, I think, we can figure out. And off set phase, we can figure out. The concern is the speed of multi-phase. And, we have highlighted it throughout this season, and it just showed again. I think maybe they were trying to move the game on a little bit. They were trying to put a little bit more line speed in it from set piece. And what we saw is they got too narrow. They got too focused on the ball. Bundyaki made a number of poor decisions. He wasn't helped by his inside or his outside, but it just looked quite shambolic. But if you go right through the game, and let's cut the second half out, because they were so almost demoralized at that point. We can say that they were fatigued, and we weren't seeing a true indication of what Ireland can do. But look at the first half, and the difference in line speed between Ireland and England, it's just ridiculous. There's a huge gap. How quickly the first defender leads off for England, it's absolutely sprinting into the face of the first receiver. It's incredible. He exposes himself a little bit, and there's, if I was coaching against England, you can see a couple of areas where they are vulnerable because they sprint up so quickly. For example, there's a big elbow or a big gap inside that first defender that can be exploited, and Ireland never did. But that line speed is so much greater than what Ireland are doing. We look as if we're just well off the pace in what we're trying to do systematically. And there's a bigger question here. What we have is we've got a defensive coach who seems to have been left behind a little bit in what the best defences in the world are doing, who's about to take on the role of head coach without actually any significant experience in either a head coach or an attacking coach role. So there's that other side of the conversation that we can't even touch at the moment. But immediately, our defensive system is behind the others, and it's not going to change It's not going to change by making a couple of tweaks and saying we're missing individual tackles. That's not the issue. We can miss that. We're missing those individual tackles because players can get up speed against us. They can take the ball coming on to pace, and their ruck ball can be so much quicker. And it's exactly the opposite of what we're doing.
Jerry, when everything's sort of falling apart like this, is it almost better if it goes bad, for it to go really badly from a Joe Schmidt perspective?
Yes, because we have to finally have a bit of optimism.
Honestly,
here,
there might be something in this, though, because in 2007, we didn't get a sense it was going to be, we're going to be absolutely
it's
screwed.
It's a proper wake-up call.
It's a real, like, this is fundamental.
There's no hiding away from this.
Nothing's working.
Well, 2007, we nearly lost to Italy. We basically did lose Italy.
But there wasn't the same level of panic.
It might have been better off had we lost to Italy.
Yeah.
Ron O'Gara got an illegal try near the end of the game that actually saved us. It might have been better off. I don't know. Yeah, at least there are another couple of warm-up games as well, albeit we look ahead to them now. We're going to face Wales in Warren Gatland's last match after 12 years in charge. Mm. The most iconic, successful coaching figure in their history, and that's saying something, in a sellout in the
He wouldn't want to be. He wouldn't want to beat Ireland. Would he?
No, not at all. They're going to be locked and fully loaded. Oh, yeah, and they've had the weekend off, and they're also match-hardened from two games against England. They beat a core of that English side last time they played. So that looks pretty ominous. I think Ireland, I've got a few new selection issues that we've already highlighted, myself and Shane, and that Joe Schmidt and the think tank are going back now and going, whoa, this throws our plans into a little bit of upheaval. Where do we go from this? Which players do they bring in next week before they've got until more or less this day next week to pick their squad?
Yeah.
That's when they've got to submit the 31-man
squad.
Well,
who else? Because we've spent a lot of time on Best, but what about other senior players? I mean, CJ Stander, what's he offering at the moment?
Well,
Bundyaki may be another one. You
that's
know,
what I was about to offer. I was about to say that the selection issues now are just not about who's going to make the 31-man squad, but very much the composition of the 15 for the final game against Wales at home, which is almost must win. And then the first pool game against Scotland, which is also must win. Basically, the end of the warm-up and the start of the pool stages will define a lot of what happens in the Ireland's World Cup. If Ireland get a big send-off themselves at the Aviva Stadium, with Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray back in harness and playing well and beat Wales at home and go off to Japan feeling better about themselves with the full house cheering them on, then, you know, that will, I don't necessarily think, mask a lot of the flaws, but will at least send them off in a good, positive frame of mind. And I'd, like Simon has suggested, I think this will certainly concentrate their minds. I think I'm hearing in the camp that although there's been a lot of rugby skills-based training, it's been very much fitness-orientated. That much of the last 9 weeks, apart from a couple of weeks off, that they've been about fitness, been purely pre-season fitness, which has echoes, I know, of 2007. And that there hasn't been an awful lot of rugby work as such, rugby training sessions. And that certainly looked like that was the case on Saturday, and certainly in terms of the defence, there was a lack of communication. It looked like they'd hardly done a training session together in defence between them. So I think that they will become more match focused now. And you're right, Simon, it can hardly get any worse. And when push comes to shove, this Irish team, whatever team pitches up against Scotland in the opening game, is capable of beating Scotland, Japan and winning this pool, and then is capable of a one-off big performance in the quarter-final. But I admit, on Saturday's Evans, we're slightly clutching at straws there, and it's based on increasingly past memories.
What do you think, Shane? Is it clutching at straws to say, certainly from Joe Schmidt's perspective, if he's got some tough calls to make, they're made easier when the performance is so, so bad?
I hope he'll have been given some clarity in making some tough decisions off the back of that game. Now you can't throw out everything that he's done and the people he's worked with and the people he trusts over the last X amount of years. And also there's a huge amount of really good quality players there. And also Joe Schmidt is a brilliant coach and a brilliant tactician, and he will certainly in attack, I think he will. We didn't see very little from Ireland. You'd imagine that what's rectifiable would certainly be getting the basis right around scrum and line out, and then if we get that right, then traditionally and with all evidence that we can we can produce some positive first phase attack. And I think a couple of key decisions or a number of key decisions may be made off the back of that result of the weekend. What I would be concerned at, and what I'm surprised at, is again, sorry to harp on about the defensive system, but I was expecting to see Ireland have a, you know, quite a significant change in the way they were defending, more akin to that Wales and or England model. And we haven't seen that move on. And I think if they're sitting around today, you know, a few weeks out from a World Cup, having done, and even if they have been doing, been focusing on fitness, they will have been doing a lot of rugby sessions as well, or rugby sessions that have fitness built into them. And the fact that they've had this period where they haven't made that really significant change, that's what I find surprising. And if you're, you know, as I said, a few weeks out from the World Cup now, to go, right, lads, we're making this change, or, you know, to this different model, I'm not sure if that's, you know, going to smack of panic, or how it's going to be received, or if it's even doable in this short period. So from that regard, I think some of the decisions will be made easier, but the underlying issues remain, and whether they can be changed in such a short period of time, I'm not sure.
I take your point, Shane. Essentially, it doesn't matter who you pick if the systematic errors remain in place and if you don't have the right...
The 31-man squad feels a little irrelevant at the moment compared to the form.
Yeah, but the main topic of debate, and then suddenly it almost seems irrelevant.
I am still very interested. I am interested in the key decisions that he needs to make there, though, Shane, that you think might have been clarified, because we did talk a lot about Rory Best. What else? Who else do you think, in terms of a starting 15, are there other big names who are under threat now?
Well, you know, I think there's a number of names who will not be, you know, sleeping too well. I think, you know, how the back row works. I think, you know, they'll be, I think he'll be looking with a kind of an open mind right the way across the back line, the back row. I think in the centres as well, I think that's, you know, how that potentially lines up, and what sort of, you know, performances that he's expecting out of someone like Gary Ringrose as well. I think, you know, Gary's, you know, been so good for Ireland so many times, but, you know, we're seeing in a sort of a crucial period that you need really big personalities to stand up and actually accept responsibility, and he'll be one that they'll be looking to. I think, you know, Jacob Stockdale, as well, as crazy as it sounds, he's, in, you know, a machine to score tries, but, you know, they'll have to be doing a really significant amount of work with him on how he's defending, and he needs to be helped out from his inside. So, you know, you've got, you know, all of a sudden, from what was a, you know, quite a settled team, you've got, you know, quite a number of areas where there's starting to be decisions made, and you wouldn't be entirely certain, you know, what that, you know, starting lineup would be. You know, there's, I think there's a quite a number of decisions that he could make, or options he could be looking at, and almost has to.
And in other places, there's no options effectively, because, you know, scrum half is clearly Conor Murray, out half is clearly Johnny Sexton, not least if it looks as if Joey Kirby might not even be fit for the Scottish game.
Although rumours over the weekend, or reports over the weekend, I think in the Sunday Times, that Johnny Sexton picked up a bang in training.
He picked up a small bang in training, a maul collapsed on his leg, and he's got a little bit of a leg strain, but no structural damage. I think the plan was for him to have played last week, and that didn't transpire. I still think he's going to line up against Wales in the final home game. I'm not too sure it would be very wise to send him out to Principality Stadium next Saturday, which maybe mean have a look at Jack Carty. But, you know, with Carberry out of the frame, the investment being made in Carberry over the last 2 years, with no Paddy Jackson there, no Ian Madigan there, the cupboard is quite bare, which means, of course, that the Scots are going to come hell for leather after Johnny Sexton, no doubt, in that pool opener. The cupboard's not particularly full in fullback either, with Simon Zebo having decamped to France, more's the pity. Jordan Larmour hasn't really convinced as a proper alternative to Rob Kearney, and nobody else has really been tried there. Like, Andrew Conway hasn't even been tried there for Munster. Jacob Stockdale hasn't even really been tried there for Ulster. I think maybe two games apiece last season. So there's a few other positions where there won't be that many issues, but it's not because Ireland are spoiled for choice. And the other one is, you really wouldn't know who would be James Ryan's second row partner at the moment, other than you know that James Ryan will definitely be one of the starting locks.
What about a back row of Henderson, Peter Manny at seven, and Jack Conan?
Well, I certainly think Jack Conan has been the form number eight in the country since the turn of the year. And I'm curious to why he hasn't appeared yet. I presume he's going to play in Cardiff, and it's going to be very interesting to watch his performance.
CJ Stander has, you can't fault his work ethic in terms of the tackle count, along with Josh Van de Vleer. I think they were the only two that were in double figures, but his impact in games has become increasingly negligible as a ball carrier, especially, which used to be his forte.
And they're absorbing tackles.
Yes.
Which
yes.
you need to, but you also need some dominant ones.
Yeah. Whereas Jack Conan, there's almost something old-fashioned, old-school number eight, Victor Costello style, when he charges off the base of that scrum. He's just become a more dynamic carrier. I think also he's got a very good skill set, good hands, you know, good offloading game. So I would think certainly that Jack Conan could well come into the picture.
Okay. I think we've got line speed in defence, communication in defence, the system, defensive system, malfunctioning lineouts. I've been jotting them all down. The captain's performance, the psychological damage, the lack of leadership, no turnovers, no Andy Farrell is heading. Okay, there's a lot of problems, but I'm sure they'll all be solved.
Things can only get better.
Things can only get better. Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, guys.
New Zealand, to Ryan Clotty, getting for the try on the near side of the pitch. Oh, yeah, I don't believe it.
Ryan Clotty scores!
Oh, my goodness!
They've managed it. It's 22 each.
Have you got a chance?
No. No, I genuinely would be happy with a 20-point differential.
What?
I think that would be a success, yeah.
Losing by 20 points would be a success?
Yeah.
Come on.
Losing by 20 points would be a success? Yeah. Come on.
Still running with the ball, Zeebo in a bit of space, and there's plenty of room too. All Blacks flying back in defence. Off it goes to Julian Savir. He can't go anywhere. 5 metre scrum.
Oh, what a play from Ireland! This is it, really. This is it for Ireland. They can put this one out of reach.
I do not expect them, unless they are demanded to by the referee, to release this ball from the scrum.
Less than 5 minutes. Here's Heaslip. Well, he picks it up quickly and off he goes. Drops it off to Henshaw! Robbie Henshaw scores it!
They did it! He bangs it down and oh my goodness, I think, dare I say it, this could be it for Ireland.
Handy conversion for Joey Carberry to make his contribution on debut. All Blacks charge. Up go the flags!
History in the making, and they are really good for an Ireland. They deserve this, and what a night it's going to be.
What a triumph it is for Joe Smith, Kiwi boy, who's engineered some real history. Into the grandstand it goes. Ireland beat the All Blacks for the first time.
All right, before we get stuck into Rory McIlroy's win last night, we should mention the drama at Headingley, third Ashes test between England and Australia. You just know somebody has done something special in English sport when Ross Kemp posts a topless video from his holidays to salute the achievement.
Quite simply, if Ben Stokes is not Sportsman of the Year, then I have a full head of hair. Ben Stokes, you are legend.
You are a legend. Well done to Barry Reid for spotting that one. Murph, tell us all about it. What did Ben Stokes go and do?
Well, he scored 135 not out to take England from a humiliation, which is what it was, 67 all out for their first innings, to the most unlikely Ashes victory in possibly the history of the entire, 140 years history of the Ashes. And a lot of people who have watched a lot more cricket matches than I have said that it's the greatest test innings of all time. So he scored 2 runs for the first 74 balls that he faced. Something like that.
It doesn't sound like a lot.
No, he basically just stood there and blocked for hours. Like, there was an hour and a half at the end of, what night was that, Saturday night, yes, of course. And just didn't score, just like block, block, block.
Why?
Because England needed him and Joe Root to survive to the end of the day to give them a chance at winning yesterday. So then, as the needs of his team changed, he changed completely his style of play. And for the last, he got 70, over the course of like 10 overs, just batted them to victory. The most outrageous.
With no margin for error. They were one wicket away from losing. So it was all high risk stuff. Yeah.
And I actually don't want to talk about Ben Stokes on. Because I want to talk about the narrow-shouldered, spectacles-wearing, and yes, bald cricketer. Jack Leach.
Good man, Jack.
Batting at 11, and therefore in the eyes of his coaches and his teammates, he's the worst batter on the team. So imagine if beside Lionel Messi, as he's scoring his most ridiculous ever hat-trick, there's the best player at your five-a-side playing alongside him. And it's not just like, oh, what a hilarious juxtaposition this is. It actually matters how your man from the five-a-side does. If he can't keep his end up, Messi gets taken off, sent off, you know, the game is over. So that was Jack Leach yesterday beside Ben Stokes. He had to defend his wicket, so he did. Stokes would play five of the six deliveries of every over. On the fifth delivery, he would get a one, so that Leach would have to face one ball, and then it'd be Stokes back on strike for the next over. So this would happen every single over. On the fourth or fifth ball, Stokes would take a one, and Leach would walk down, about to face a 90-mile-an-hour bowler, take his glasses off in the middle of this outrageous sporting occasion, clean them, defend his wicket somehow, and then leave it up to Ben Stokes to do something, you know, absolutely ridiculous for the next five deliveries. I mean, the police chief in LA Confidential was playing in my head every time he took his glasses off, you know. Can you at least get rid of the glasses, boyo? I can't think of a single man on the force who wears them. But it was like he makes one mistake, Stokes is nowhere. And you know, it's not like he's doing what he's being paid to do. I mean, he's a spin bowler. Like, if he makes a mistake, it's not just, oh, I let the team down. It's like, I stopped Superman from saving the world.
He didn't just defend, though, Murph. What are you talking about?
Well, he scored one run, which tied the game. But nevertheless, pretty amazing.
I did see the most fascinating aspect of all the many fascinating aspects was Ben Stokes at those moments when he was watching his partner just try to stay alive, to keep both of them alive. He was, I don't know if he's talking, he was doubled over. Like, he couldn't look. So, you know, when you see maybe somebody in a penalty shootout and one or two of their teammates just can't look, they're facing the other way, but you don't know that because you're staring at the goal. Leach is staring at the bowler who is running in beside his fellow batsman. And all he sees is his fellow batsman thinking, this guy's definitely getting out here. And with his head down. And he did say afterwards, it was a little distracting.
Yeah, he said actually a couple of different interviews. And I mean, it's not like a penalty shootout where you're not showing. I mean, Stokes, if Leach plays a shot, Stokes has to run the run.
Oh yeah, he's part of the action.
Actually have to be alive to the possibility of your man Leach deciding to hit.
It was
bonkers.
I still think somebody... It was amazing. You know, Murph, I know, I'm not going to rain your parade, but I have a thing about cricket fielding, and I just think sometimes they get too much praise for simple catches and not enough criticism for drop catches. I'm just saying there were a couple of chances there, and there was a run out that should have been completed. But listen, these are just the
top level sport.
It's all going to be part of the documentary, which is probably already out in Sky Sports. How the 2019 Ashes were won, even though they're not won yet.
Yeah, the third test at least.
Yeah, okay.
But I mean, you know, Ben Stokes did take an unbelievable catch in the World Cup as well. The video went mega viral.
Yes, that was incredible.
Ken McGrath from Waterford did happen to tweet, you know, well, it's all well and good, but can you do it with three Cork lads hanging off you? Which, to be fair, is also not a bad point.
I was watching Rory McIlroy win the Tour Championship last night on Sky, and I got the sense they were very much trying to build up some tension between the two players, whether it really exists or not. Two gladiators going at it. Not a lot of talk out there. Brooks doesn't want to talk, and Rory doesn't care. All this kind of stuff. As for McIlroy, he did try a little bit to go WWE in his interview on the Golf Channel.
You know, going up against the number one player in the world today, you know, he got one over on me in Memphis, and I wanted to sort of try to get some revenge today. So to play like that, you know, alongside Brooks and get the win the FedEx Cup, it's awesome. It's amazing, you know, how different things can be in a year.
Yeah, it's not exactly Jake the Snake Roberts versus Ravishing Rick Rude.
He unloaded on. You'll never guess what Rory McIlroy's just called Brooks Koepka.
If Rory starts winning majors again, this could develop into something all right. Alex Myers, senior writer at Golf Digest, is on to talk Rory McIlroy. Alex, great to chat to you again.
Great chatting to you.
How impressed were you by Rory last night?
Well, certainly very impressed. Obviously, you know, you could see some tight swings with all those guys. I know it's not a major championship, of course, but they're playing for the biggest, you know, purse ever in the history of golf. Really the biggest payday, I think, in the history of any sport. $15 million on the line and a $10 million gap from 15 to 5 for second. So a lot of pressure there. Rory obviously came through. He played the best golf of anyone yesterday. He picked the right day and the right time to come through and give his best.
Yeah, probably a few boxing fights and the rest of it might have... Yeah. Garnered that kind of money, but You know, but let's start with the money, because McIlroy was interesting on it beforehand. We played a clip earlier on the show, and he seemed a little bit like he was saying, "Look, I'm gonna, if somebody's giving me 15 million to win a tournament, I'll take the 15 million, sure."
But right.
I don't think that. I think for the longevity of a tournament and the prestige, it has to be about more than that. So, were you at all uncomfortable that it basically just nobody cares anything about this tournament other than the fact that one really rich man gets even more rich?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think that is what has distinguished this tournament. And, you can't just manufacture prestige or history or anything like that. And what the tour has obviously decided to do with this event and obviously the FedEx Cup is dole out a lot of money. And that instantly gave it credibility. So I get where Rory's coming from. But I also think it does make it stand out as kind of the event where someone wins a lot of money, and so that's kind of become the identity there. So it is kind of funny that the guy who at the beginning of the week was saying that the money's not that big a deal, and he quoted that rap song and how he wants to share it with everybody, which is beautiful sentiment from Rory, as always. Love listening to him talk and hear his thoughts. But it is funny that you're right, the guy who probably needed it the least ended up winning it. But maybe that's why he was able to do it and able to concentrate under pressure while so many other people struggled.
Yeah, he was pretty relaxed. I mean, one or two wobbles, but that's always the way with Rory McIlroy. If he's holding those 10, 12, 14-foot putts, I guess like most golfers, but particularly with him because he puts himself in position so often, he's going to win. And he held a few of them under pressure last night.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And, he put on a clinic. You're right. He did have those two late bogeys, and then he made that big par save late with a nice 10-foot putt. But, man, you could not have hit the ball any better that front nine, save for one shot, and it was on that eighth hole, which we've seen so much drama in this tournament in the past. It used to be the 17th hole, of course. That's where Bill Haas hit that shot out of the water in a playoff to win his FedEx Cup in 2011. But Rory looked like he was going to end up in the water, and he hit that edge of that drain, and it looked like it saved his ball from going in. And, so sometimes you do need a break or two. Now, I know he ended up winning by four shots, but certainly if you go in the water there, make a double, things might have looked a little different had he not taken that lead to the back nine. But certainly he took advantage of that break, had a great pitch shot, made another nice putt, as you mentioned. I think he was first yesterday in the field in strokes gained putting. So not only did he hit the ball the best yesterday, but he putted the best as well. So no surprise, he had the best score of the day and the best finish.
He was obviously helped by one or two other players. Well, I'm talking about Brooks Koepka in particular here, underperforming and making the mistakes you've alluded to with it a little bit there. We were starting to get the impression that in recent times that Brooks Koepka might be one of these almost robotic players that comes along every once in a generation and will just never stop winning. But maybe the 15 million got on top of him. I don't know what happened, but he really, the wheels came off entirely.
I mean, without a doubt. I mean, first of all, the tee shot he hit on the seventh hole where they ended up losing the ball. And then certainly those two back-to-back short missed putts, which, we never think of Brooks as being a great putter, but certainly you have to be a pretty good putter to win major championships at the rate he does. And it does seem like he always makes those putts when it matters. And I don't know if he almost got the feeling that Rory had kind of overtaken him and, it was inevitable that he was going to win or what, but it looked like he almost, lost his concentration, which you never see from Brooks in a big spot. But he missed those two short putts back-to-back holes while Rory birdied. All of a sudden, it went from a one-shot lead to a five-shot lead in the matter of minutes. So I agree, that was stunning, because Brooks has become as dependable under pressure, obviously, as anyone in the game today. And that goes back to the money. I mean, again, they're not playing for a major trophy here, but I think it shows that extra, $10 million being on the line between first and second definitely got to some of these guys.
I don't know if you picked up on this watching it yourself, Alex, but watching the coverage on Sky, they were certainly trying to make a big deal of the dynamic between Koepka and McIlroy. Koepka beat him recently, and McIlroy did say afterwards himself that he was happy to get revenge for it. But like, there was a sense that they just weren't talking to each other at all for the whole. I don't know if that's a rare thing, but they seem to be making it as though maybe. Is there any tension between these two?
I don't think there's any tension specifically between those two. I think they're, pretty competitive. I think You know, Rory looks like he's, you know, having a great time most of the time out there. But when things get serious, I think we see him get serious as well. And Brooks, you mentioned kind of that robotic feel that he gives off. He does have a Tiger feel in these big events. When he needs to concentrate, I don't think he does much chatting with anyone. I mean, he could have been playing with Dustin Johnson yesterday, and I don't think they would have been chatting much at all. So I don't think there's anything personal there. I do love that Rory admitted that, you know, beating Brooks specifically meant a lot, and why wouldn't it? I mean, he is the number one player in the world, and he did beat him head-to-head just a few weeks ago. So for him to have another opportunity to come back, and keep in mind, just a year ago, it was Rory who was playing with Tiger in that final group, and, you know, he got beat pretty bad by Tiger. So he's had a lot of people saying, why don't you come through in the final pairing? Why don't, you know, why can't you step it up at the right time? And for him to do it in the final pairing with all that money on the line and against the world number one, it certainly meant a lot to him. It's not, doesn't mean as much, I don't think, as a major would, and he's still on a 5-year drought, so to speak, with those big events. But this was big for him going forward.
Yeah, and that brings me to the question of whether or not you feel 2019 has been a good year for Rory McIlroy, which is an absolutely stupid question in many ways. He's just won this $15 million. He won the Players' Championship, you know, another prestigious tournament, the Canadian Open. But certainly this part of the world, Alex, you know, we all remember a certain opening round up the road here, a couple of hours north in Portrush, which is going to be hard to erase from our memory banks.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. And right, it's amazing that we're even asking it. But, you know, when you do win four majors by the time you're 25, you kind of start to be defined by whether you win a major. Obviously, that's how Tiger always considered if he had a great year or not. If he, you know, he could win eight times in a year, but if he didn't win a major, he wouldn't consider a great year. And I don't think Rory's quite to that level yet. So I do think he will consider this a great year. Obviously, he actually looks at these stats very closely as well. And there was much made about his strokes gain stats and how only Tiger has had a better season in that metric. So, and Rory's keeping tabs on that. So he knows he knows how much good golf he played. And certainly while Brooks is world number one, and I think no one would argue that, no one played more great golf throughout the entire season than Rory. So I think he still will hang his hat on that. He'll still continue to put himself in the mix and hopefully have more days like this on the final day when he comes through. But yeah, I mean, I think he's also getting a little frustrated that it has been 5 years since that last major.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of summing it up. Alex, great to talk to you as always. Thank you.
You got it. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
See, if you don't get this out with Motherwell, you're away, mate. Your bags and your desk, boom.
Your bags and your desk, boom.
I mean it. I'm fucking raging, speaking from my heart. Who would I want in? I've got my Terry Butcher in.
Mr. Tate, how you doing?
Not too good after tonight. You got the job on the technicality of a legend who recommended you.
Take no beep, I take no beep, I take no, I take no, I take no beep. Just so what's up, don't gotta get so deep. You know me, but I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell me, I can't yell, can't yell, can't yell me.
You have lost the fans tonight, you don't deserve the fans.
Listen to fans, just need to fucking work on it.
You are nothing, you are a fool, and you are a waste of time. Good night.
Oh, the Guinness Book of Records, stop, get a grip!
He's your biggest fool. Stop.
Quick reminder before we wrap things up, Andy Moran on the player's chair tomorrow. Always a fascinating character to listen to, and I would imagine it should be a great conversation with Richie. We'll also have Usheen and Mike Quirk, two more fascinating characters, in on Wednesday to preview the match itself. And I'm sure there'll be more All-Ireland build-up later in the week. Maybe even a fair view for the week that's in it, Ken. Dry for five and all that.
Well, I don't make any promises, Alan.
Thanks, Ken. Good sell. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Will. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you
tomorrow. Thank you, Ken.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Market, mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.